Jok Madu Jok, I'm currently a professor of anthropology and public affairs at Syracuse University in New York, in the United States.
Professor, you have been very critical about analyzing the situation on the ground, and I would like maybe us to start with the first family. Of late, you have been also analyzing so many things concerning the first family. What do you know about the first family? What is going on?
Well, the first family is made up of individuals who are very, very different from one another. Of course, we know the president, and the main issue with the president recently, of course, is the public curiosity about his state of health, and most particularly about his fitness for office at this stage, given some observations that have happened, including his apparent inability to be physically mobile, but also in terms of his cognitive capacity to articulate when he's talking in public. So this has raised concerns about his capacity to continue in his position to run the country. So that is one thing that we are hearing a lot from within the family. The second person, of course, is First Lady, and First Lady is a very humble, really gracious and a nice person. We are seeing how she's somebody who tries to keep the calm and unity of the family, and the children are different, different characters, different passions, different ambitions, and the person of interest is Adud Salva Kiir, who is now the presidential advisor for special projects, which is the position that is unclear what its constitutional mandate is and what the job description is, what are the special projects, and where does her power begin and where does it end in terms of executive powers. And so this is the person that has attracted the most scrutiny of late because of a variety of things, above all the involvement of a company that she's a shareholder in, perhaps a majority shareholder, a company called Crawford, with a lot of subsidiaries, which are now involved in a dealing with the government, where Crawford and its subsidiary of e-government, there is something called Capital Pay, and they are involved in collecting taxes and levies for the government, which has really raised eyebrows, not just locally, but even internationally. It was mentioned recently in the UN Human Rights Report and in the United States the Department of Commerce as a potential company to be listed as corrupt and potentially to be sanctioned if it continues to feature in that way. So it has indicated to us that that Adud is not being transparent. The company is not contracted transparently the company, with the government, the country doesn't know, the people of South Sudan don't know what was the process by which this company was contracted, because it surprises people. There is nowhere in the world where a private corporation is put in charge of collecting taxes and levies without a particularly transparent contracting process, vetting by parliament and so forth. And nobody knows what percentage does it get paid. Is it Crawford paying the government, or is it government paying Crawford for the services that it renders? So okay. The First Family is caught in these corruption issues. But then, of course, there is also the issues of power and ambition. Badut is now being heard saying, showing interest in becoming vice president in place of Waniga, and first duty chair of the SPLM. The idea is that that she would then be in line to take over from her father, should the father relinquish power, or should anything happen to him, God forbid.
Professor, does this have a confirmation or an evidence of her claiming, or maybe trying to seek for the vice president and maybe being the second command in the party, or it is an allegation that people are talking about? Is there any concrete evidence that can prove that she is also aiming for that?
There is no written or recorded evidence of her saying that, right? But she works with people, and these people have heard her say things like this. And we also heard that her mother, First Lady, doesn't want her to get into this political space, because that simply generates a lot of criticism from the public, and she puts this puts her in the eyes of the people. And I think as a mother, she doesn't want her daughter to get into a space where so many people would be against her. That is also what we hear. So all of this, of course, is being reported by people who are working within the family of the president, individuals who don't want to be mentioned, because, of course, they fear losing their jobs or reprisals and so forth.
Okay.
So that is the evidence is tenuous. It's not something that is concrete.
Okay, Professor, we have seen like today the first lady has traveled to the hometown of Akon via a wheel. What do you know about their travel? And we're here, and also the president will also be traveling maybe tomorrow to Akon as well. What are you hearing? Why is the family traveling to hometown together for the first time?
We are hearing that this is a private travel. It's not a state visit. It's going home for purposes of reconnecting with family, and also the president being in a condition where he's not well. He wants to have gather the family to perform a blessing ceremony. There will probably be spiritual leaders coming to spear masters and coming to him to pray for his health. So it is primarily a private trip. But of course, people want this to be an opportunity for him to address several issues, the most important being this issue of succession. And for the local people, the leaders in his community, to ask him questions about what is going on when it comes to why the country is in such a bad shape in terms of economy, security, unity of the country. People want to ask him these questions. And so they want to take advantage of this to have a gathering.
Okay.
I think people are also concerned about these recent debate going on social media about one people where the president is from, and the people of Awil over insults that one social media person has launched against Awil people, and Awil people begin to suspect that this person is being sent or being propped by somebody in the first family or in the government to attack Awil people, most particularly because of one ambassador, Garandeng Agor, a businessman from Awil, who has recently been very vocal, pointing out all the loopholes of corruption going on in the country. And for this, there was rumor that he would be arrested because of his vocal criticism of some things in the government. Garandeng Agor, in one public gathering, mentioned that he's shocked by this issue of oil cargoes being given to individuals, and he asked, "Where else on earth does the government issue oil cargoes to individuals?" He talked about money, the way corruption is being talked about. The people in the Ministry of Finance or in the bank will get orders from above to bring money, to give money. And so when they are accused of corruption, it is usually not just them. It is also the higher-ups demanding this money be given to them. So Garang was very critical of this, and he was also concerned about the killings that happen in the minefields of Jebel Kaltan, where a large number of young people from Awil were rounded up and were brought to Juba with an eye to recruiting them into the army and be sent to the war front in Jonglei. And so when Garang was talking about these issues, there was this talk of him being arrested, and the people of young people from Awil gathered at his residence to try to protect him. So all this has created a situation where there is potential for a more explosive relationship between Awil and Awan, or Gogreal, at least in general. And I think president is likely to be asked about this, and he will likely address people there, given that he himself has once said that he is from Awil. So it is unfair, it is illogical for anybody to think that the president would send somebody to, or his family, to send somebody to insult Awil people, given that the relationship between Awil and Gogreal is a historic relationship where they are one people essentially.
Professor, of late, the status of President Kiir, is he immobile? Is he on a wheelchair? What do you hear? What do you know about it? Or is he moving? How is it now, this week?
Oh, he's moving. He's able to stand up and walk with the support of a cane, obviously. He walks haltingly and very slow. He has that history of his knee injuries that he incurred during a plane crash back in the 90s in Kenya. And so the impact of that injury is beginning to affect his mobility with age. But he's not physically able to perform some of the duties of the presidency. You will recall the video of him walking in the halls of the African Union in Ethiopia, where he people tried to shield the cameras from showing him walking in such a manner. I don't think the way he's walking should be an issue. an issue because the man is elderly and has an injury. So walking slowly should not be a big political issue. The question is his capacity to talk and articulate and think. If his cognitive capacity is waning, I think that it would be a more concerning issue. And that is what we do not know for a fact. If it was an open society, it was a democratic society that we think we should be, the president would be forced to undergo a medical test to assess his fitness for office. But of course, in our country, such things are not straightforward. You would have to have a parliament that can demand that. And we know the state of our parliament is such that it's not independent of the executive. The separation of powers has essentially disappeared in South Sudan. And so the president, healthy or not healthy, might be kept there as a face by individuals behind him who want to keep him there so that they can stay in office.
Okay.
People in the cabinet, people like Adut herself, the daughter, people like the Vice President Hussein Abdelbaghi might be interested in keeping the president in that space as president, even though they know he's not able to optimally operate and run the country. But because they are entrenched in power behind him, obviously it's in their interest that he stays there, even though they know he cannot run the country.
Professor Jok, let us look at the issue of the political detainees, or maybe some of the detainees that were detained recently and others previously for quite some time. What do you want to say about this? Who are the people behind the detainees in South Sudan and their status so far? What do you know?
Well, a lot of detainees, for example, the former office holders like Vice President Benjamin Boulmel, or people who used to work in the president's office like Ambassador Ajing, Ben Ajing, and Dominic Duke, people like the activist who was brought from Dubai via Kenya. These are people who were detained due to some power struggles within the presidency, right? People like Manasseh Machar Boliai, who was a security person, they were not really, or even former Minister of Finance, I hear that he has been released to go home, but stay put in Juba. Honorable Marial, who was Minister of Finance, they were arrested. In public, we are told that it is about corruption. But if it was about corruption, it should involve announcement of charges, which then should quickly get them to arraignment in court and investigation and trial. The laws of South Sudan are very clear that when people are arrested, essentially they should be arrested by means of a judicial order. And then once that the arrest has happened, they should be presented in court. There is just no any other way to think about this. Regardless of what political opinion we have about them, the fact is that the laws of South Sudan are very clear on the due process of the law. This one is not being exercised. So we think it is the rivalries within the office the competition over small dwindling resources of the country that once some people are in positions of power, they push for detention of these people because they are rivals, and their exit from jail might bring them back to the playing field where they might be a potential contenders for public office once again. So I think their detention has nothing to do with law or crime or accusations.
Okay.
Otherwise, the state would not be silent on this. The state would announce it to the public so that everybody knows what these people are charged of.
Okay.
And how their cases will be handled.
Mm. Professor,
it is a sign of a decaying state when the state, and particularly the government, when it is weakening, it asserts its power by using these underhanded practices that have nothing to do with the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Professor, we are hearing a lot of people are concerned with the expenditure of the 43rd anniversary of South Sudan and even the travel of the first family to Akon. By any chance, do you know how much, like in terms of expenditure, they have spent in the first anniversary and what is likely to be spent on this private visit to Akon?
I don't have the figures, but we know that that obviously it's the people of South Sudan that are paying for this, right? The SPLM, SPLA celebrations were underwritten by combination of wealthy South Sudanese who are beneficiaries of opaque contracts, government contracts that they get, from the oil cargoes to delivery of vehicles to food that is given to the army. These contractors, these business moguls, do pay a little bit into this celebration, but above all, it is simply money ordered directly from the Ministry of Finance, from Revenue Authority, from the Central Bank. We don't know how much. Obviously, given the size of the celebrations, it's very expensive. And the money came from the pockets of South Sudanese, from what was supposed to be invested in the welfare of the people, like money of these infrastructure projects, like the road that takes goods from Uganda to Juba, is falling apart and it's not being repaired.
Mm.
The road that was financed through oil to Bahargezal is nowhere near even taking off, let alone completion. And of course, South Sudanese are more and more. Over 93% of South Sudanese are 10 times poorer today than they were at the time of independence. And the death toll from violence is unbelievable. And many children dying from preventable diseases because the donor community that used to pay for these things has receded, and the government has not taken responsibility for the welfare of the people.
Okay.
Now, if you are going to take money from this, from the government, and spend it on a big party for one day, instead of investing that money in a hospital. Even in Juba itself, when you look at the Juba Teaching Hospital, the country's biggest referral hospital, you go in there and you get sick from being inside the hospital rather than going to get healed. It is unbelievable. It is a shame. It is a crime for the people of South Sudan to continue to suffer to this level 20 years on since the end of the Liberation War. It's unfathomable. It is unconscionable. And the president and his team have to bear the responsibility for what has happened to the people of South Sudan. There is just no any other way around it.
Professor, on the 43rd anniversary, we had Secretary General of the SPLM, Dr. Akol, saying any South Sudanese who feels that South Sudan is not good for him or her should leave and find another country. What does this mean to the citizens of this country?
It's the same language that we have heard from stalwarts of the party and from government ministers on the SPLM ticket, from Michael Makuei to Marcel Elia to Dr. Paul himself, mocking people, saying that when people complain about the healthcare system, he says things like, oh, you know, we used to live off tree root to treat ourselves during the Liberation War with senior advisor to the president, Kwame Nyang Juk, saying, if you are going to be hungry and you die of hunger while you are leaving dogs and frogs and things like this, you are the one to blame and nobody else. And things like this. Yes, Akol Pol was talking about how if you are against the SPLM interbinorate, which is a language sort of a Juba Arabic term, phrase, that means basically, you are toast if you don't like SPLM, if you don't support SPLM. All I am saying is that that language is typical of how the SPLM has been visionless, how the SPLM does not have any articulation of what they want to do as a ruling party or a party that is vying for elections. Why should the people of South Sudan continue to support it? It doesn't. It relies on liberation credentials. We liberated it, so the people of South Sudan should be beholden to the SPLM forever because it quote unquote liberated the country, as if the country was liberated by ideas only, and not also by physical contribution of the people of South Sudan, fighters and non-fighters, people who paid for the cost of liberation.
Okay, Professor. With the recently concluded preliminary consultation in Arusha by the former head of state Isaiah Kikwete, do you think these talks this time around will bear fruits? What do you see happening after the fail of Tumaini and many other initiatives, these C5 meetings? What do you think? What do you see different this time round?
Well, the point is that no dialogue can happen if the government doesn't want to dialogue, right? If the SPLM government is not interested in genuine sitting down together with all the political parties, with all the stakeholders in the country, which is what this country needs, then nobody can force them. Kikwete and the African Union or regional powers, they have no power to force the government of South Sudan to sit down with all the stakeholders.
Okay.
The country currently nothing can rescue South Sudan but a genuine sit down by all concerned to talk and to have a constitutional dialogue where you discuss what is the problem and then offer a solution. And that solution become part of what we write down in our constitution, right?
Okay.
So the problem of South Sudan is this commitment to solving the violence by means of the military force. The commitment of the government that it must win militarily is what is going to drag this country into more poverty and potential disintegration.
Professor
because
Jok,
you cannot win militarily.
Professor Jok,
yes.
Do you see election happening in the next 5 months, come December this year?
Well, the yes or no. Yes, in the sense that if the government really wants to do these elections, they are going to do it, regardless of whether it has met the basic fundamental principles of an election, like having a real electoral law, like having a constituency demarcation, like having a voter registration, and having money to support logistical nightmare that it will be to get the ballots to all corners of the country.
Mm.
If you are going to cut corners and say the areas that are in war will not be able to have the ballot, the areas that are unreachable due to road conditions, and you're going to focus on towns and cities, then they might have elections. And I think that is what they are going to try to do. Just have elections by all means.
Mm-hmm.
Whether many people vote or not, whoever will vote will be the decision maker in terms of who comes to power. I think a lot of South Sudanese want that because they want this parliament, for example, to be made up of people they have elected. Because right now they are unable to hold their electorate, their representatives accountable because they didn't elect them. The MPs themselves are not beholden to the people because they know they are appointed and the president can fire them any day,
okay,
elected or not elected.
Okay.
And so I think that is a yes. But a no is that if you really want to do a genuine election that that can be meaningful, I think it is too late to hold elections in South Sudan.
Okay. Professor Jok, with your parting message to the South Sudanese and the government, given the insecurity, the starvation, the displacement, and also lack of salaries and almost failed state, what message do you want to pass to our citizens and the government sitting in South Sudan?
That is a difficult one. The first thing is to say, for the government to say, enough with violence, enough with war. We are not going to pursue a military solution to the crisis, to the security crisis we have. Let us sit down and talk about what the issues are. That is one. The second, I think the government has to take a step back and look at the conditions of the people of South Sudan currently. Not only are they suffering and dying, the whole country has become an embarrassment to its citizens on a global stage, given how much the whole world had rejoiced about the independence of South Sudan and the promise that South Sudan presented.
Hmm.
And all of it is now squandered to the point where we have, not only are we a laughing stock on a global stage, we are also being cheated of our resources, the dealings that are happening between South Sudan, a few elite, with the neighboring countries, buying and selling, is become to the advantage of outsiders and not to the advantage of South Sudanese. If you look at the market today, even just shopping areas of Juba, you will find that South Sudanese have become the cleaners of the street and outsiders are the owners. So we are back to the hierarchies of the colonial era, where the local people are the servants and the outsiders are their masters. If our leaders take a look and step back from their posh offices and look at the faces of their people, they will see that we are a colonized society. We are a society where our citizens don't have trust in their government, and it's a country where citizens don't trust each other because divisions are being fanned as a way to govern. This current government is governing through divisions. I think our leaders owe it to ourselves and to themselves and to the country and, the, and to the legacies of people who have come before them to take a look, take a real close look at the eyes of our children and rethink the way we are governing this country.
Okay.
It's a shame. Thank you.
Professor Jok, thank you so much for your time to speak to us again about the situation that is the current political and also the humanitarian side of what's going on in the country. I would like to say thank you so much for your time, Professor.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.